Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for December 18th, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. And I've got a couple of segments, a couple of interviews scheduled for tonight. First interview, both pre-recorded, with Larry Burns, who is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, talking about the Central American Free Trade Agreement and related matters. And then an interview with the author Simon Head, who has just published a book called The New Ruthless Economy, which was subsidized by the Century Fund, formerly the 20th Century Fund, and published by Oxford University Press. And it's all about the new workplace, where we're all timed and automated and sped up and supervised within an inch of our lives, or maybe beyond that measure. Before we get to those interviews, first a couple of news headlines. Caught me by surprise, so I'm not fully organized here yet. First of all, the Chicago branch of the Federal Reserve Bank conducts a regular survey and puts together a National Economic Activity Index. That was deeply negative through June of this year, went slightly negative in July, August, finally went positive in September, and in November now is firmly in the positive territory, at the highest level since March 2000, a surge from a growth in output, but it is still being dragged down by low employment numbers. So this theme for the U.S. economy continues. Pretty good production numbers, pretty good sort of macro numbers, but the job market has yet to hear the good news, although there are signs of improvement in that front. The weekly tally of initial claims for unemployment insurance fell. Last week, the number released every Thursday morning, a count of the people who've just lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance to sign up for benefits. It's a very sensitive and timely indicator of the state of the job market, and that's now down at 353,000, well below the sort of 400,000 recessionary level, and on quite an improving trend over the last 6 months or so. The less volatile moving average, four-week moving average, 362,000, also down considerably over the last several weeks. The number of people continuing to draw benefits for unemployment insurance, the four-week average also fell there, too. So it looks like slowly the job market is getting better, but not as much better as some of the headline numbers are. The weekly ABC News Money Magazine measure of consumer attitudes, which is a reflection of how people feel about the national economy as well as their personal finances, is now stuck 3 weeks in a row at minus 11, a pretty low level. It's recovered somewhat, rather considerably, from low levels of the summer and early fall, but it's still stuck below zero. So it's improving, but I think being held down by the state of the employment markets. What else do we have here? Couple of observations from abroad. The Conference Board's measure of leading economic indicators, those designed to forecast trends in the economy several months out, rose in November and is now in a pretty firm uptrend. The September number wasn't so good, unchanged, but ever since May of this year has been firmly in positive territory. So we're seeing considerable improvement in measures of that are designed to forecast where the economy is going several months out. And then two measures from abroad. First of all, a business climate index, IFO, Business Climate Index. IFO is a private research institute, but this index is widely followed with its measure of the German economy, a survey of businesses for their evaluations of the present and future states of the German economy. That's recovering in quite a firm uptrend now, up for eight consecutive months, and showing signs of recovery for Europe's most important economy. And also, I don't have any current releases, but the Japanese economy also seems to be continuing its improving trend. So recovery, although modest, does seem to be the story for most of the Northern Hemisphere. And even in parts of the Southern Hemisphere, Argentina, which has, of course, experienced a great economic crisis over the last several years and has been recovering, although in no small part due to the results of a debt moratorium. Well, Argentine unemployment fell now. It's three consecutive months from June's peak of 21.5% is now down to 14.3%. This is what you have to take for good news in Argentina, an unemployment rate of 14.3%. Here it would be a political crisis and a depression level. In Argentina, it's perceived as good news, but things are improving somewhat in Argentina after that wrenching economic crisis it went to. Finally, the World Bank did a report that just came out. You can find it on their website, worldbank.org, on NAFTA, the effects of NAFTA on Mexico in particular. And it says good but not great, which is very interesting coming from the World Bank, which is normally a cheerleader for free trade and orthodox economics. And it must admit that although some of the big numbers like growth and investment are up, the real wages and poverty in Mexico, although they're better than they were after the 94-95 economic crisis, are still leave a lot to be desired. And they're not exactly getting up and cheering about the state of the Mexican economy and NAFTA's influence on it. And this is especially relevant in light of the freshly negotiated Central America Free Trade Agreement. And the only free trade agreement that the Bush administration can call its own, for what that's worth. If the NAFTA precedent is any measure, it's certainly not time to break out the champagne to celebrate the signing of the CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, and its prospects of ratification by Congress are certainly not an open and shut case. So we'll see what happens, but that is in the news, and that is why the following interview with Larry Burns, who is the Director of Council on Hemispheric Affairs, why I recorded it earlier today to get his take on CAFTA and its meaning, and more broadly the state of Latin American economies and the rebellion against neoliberalism in the Southern Hemisphere. And the rest of the show will come to you on recording because I have an important mission, a holiday party, to attend to. So let's listen to Larry Burns and then Simon Head, and then I'll be back next week. But here's the rest of the show.
Welcome to WBAI, Larry Burns. The Bush administration, which doesn't seem to have been paying much attention either to trade negotiations or to Latin America, has now apparently concluded negotiations for a Central American free trade agreement. What do you make of it?
Doug, I think that actually part of your statement may not be accurate. They certainly haven't paid much attention to Latin America, but what little attention they did direct to the region has been trade-based. And the same could be said of the Clinton administration before it. That is, Washington, when it looked upon Latin America, was not concerned about the issues of social justice or equity. They thought that the Soviet menace had been liquidated, that ideology was no longer an issue in the region, and that trade was where it was at when it came to Latin America. And the Clinton administration very much focused on that thesis. And, of course, when the Bush administration came into office, it immediately got to work on trade agreements that had been initiated by the Bush administration, like the free trade agreement with Chile and similar free trade agreements with Australia and Morocco. The Central American Free Trade Agreement, such as it is, was the only trade initiative in the region that was really initiated by the Bush administration.
What are its provisions? Give us a little summary of what the agreement looks like.
Well, what the agreement does is to wipe away barriers to trade, and that includes certainly quotas and tariffs. Under the Reagan administration, a initiative called the Caribbean Basin Initiative was introduced, which eventually pretty much wiped out tariffs and quotas on 85% of Central America's exports to this country. This trade agreement over a period of time will wipe out the remaining barriers. But more importantly, it will guarantee U.S. access to the service industries of Latin America, that is, the insurance companies and the telecommunication companies. And it also will protect the intellectual property rights and copyrights and trademarks of U.S. companies. One of the real impacts will be it will prevent Central American governments, already afflicted by some of the highest AIDS figures in Latin America, HIV/AIDS figures, it will prevent them from producing generic drugs, which they're now producing. It would respect the patent rights of U.S. drug companies, which essentially would mean that for this relatively poor area in Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Costa Rica, that it would mean that the present annual cost of about $140 per AIDS patient would be translated to $10,000 a patient. It also would give U.S. Central America the right to begin the export of sugar and textile goods, apparel, to the U.S., which, of course, is a very sensitive issue in North Carolina and South Carolina, which has already lost almost 100,000 jobs in the industry in the past several years and could be pretty much liquidated. Thus, this becomes a very dicey political issue for the Bush administration.
Costa Rica didn't sign this agreement. They're continuing negotiations. What's that all about?
What they say is that the insurance companies of Costa Rica and the telecommunication companies of Costa Rica account for something like 2/3 of the country's economy, those service industries, and that to throw those open to U.S. competition, there's a Costa Rican insurance company couldn't possibly compete with its American counterparts. So this would be the death knell for these local industries. And in a real sense, Costa Rica, since it's very close to Mexico, has been well aware of the job loss and the catastrophic impact that NAFTA has had on much of the Mexican economy. And so they're very wary about this. So they have the strongest economy in Central America. And they told Washington that they need time to reflect upon. Now, of course, the Bush administration faces its own problems. Mr. Zelnick, the chief trade negotiator, is not a political person. He is a technocratic trade person. And he is not particularly concerned with the fact that since the Bush administration came into office, 3 million industrial jobs in the United States have been lost, and that even Mexico has lost almost 50% of its maquiladora industries to China, and that all of these industries are threatened by an expansion of Chinese exports, not only to the United States, but also to Central America, because of the fact that a number of these Latin American countries and Central American countries have strong trade unions that were formed during the civil wars of the 1980s throughout the region, like in Nicaragua, where they make certain demands upon management. And thus, they drive up the cost of production. And, of course, China isn't bothered with strong trade unions, so they can undersell by 30 or 40% any goods made anywhere in Latin America. So you've seen in the past year, in particular, a huge migration of industries from Central America and the Caribbean and from the rest of Latin America going to China.
And also, this agreement seems to have no environmental or labor protections provisions in it. Is that true?
Well, they would argue that there are provisions, but what happens here is that these dispute panels that were arranged for in the NAFTA, they tend to go on interminably. They go on interminably, and that they're very kind of resolution seems not to be easy at hand. And there have been relatively few disputes decided in favor of labor or environmental petitions. And it seems to have been more a matter of cosmetics to meet the political demands of a number of members of Congress in the United States who wanted to vote for free trade, but were hesitant to do so because of the fact that they would be attacked on environmental and labor rights grounds. Free trade, in general, is something that was sold to the American people during the NAFTA period as a win-win situation, a win for Mexico, a win for the United States, a win for management, and a win for labor. It has turned out to be something significantly less. There have been winners and losers, and the winners are the traditional winners, that is, the more well-placed elements of society and higher up in the economy, and the losers have been the poor and the working class.
I'm speaking with Larry Burns, who's the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C.
Even the World Bank now, they released a report a day or two ago conceding that NAFTA has not been much of a boon to Mexico. So if the World Bank, which is normally enthusiastically the free trade camp, is that's all they can say in favor of NAFTA, what is the status and the prestige of these approaches now in governing circles?
Well, of course, the Bush administration, as a matter of scriptural gospel, is for free trade. So is Bill Clinton. And in fact, Bill Clinton was one of the real villains when it came to the whole globalization movement. There was this rather glib assertion that rip down barriers to trade and you're going to have a beneficial situation, that is, goods will be driven down and everyone will benefit. The price of goods will be driven down. Now, what we've seen in the United States, for example, when it comes to agriculture, or let's take the chicken industry, which has been heavily sort of taken over, used to be a largely black industry where U.S. blacks would pluck the chickens. It wasn't particularly desirable work, and it was very poor paying. Now, it is true that it was difficult for the poultry companies to hire workers because people did not want to work for $5 an hour at abhorrent jobs. But if you had tripled the pay scale to $15, to $9, $12, you would have gotten an adequate workforce. So it's not been that there have been a shortage of labor for these jobs. It's been a shortage of cheap labor for these jobs. And that's why NAFTA was so important, because you didn't have to bring the laborers into the United States. You simply shipped the jobs to Mexico. But in the case of a country like Mexico, and one might say Central America as well, that you had both the shipment of jobs going to the region from the United States, as well as the shipment of undocumented migrant workers to the United States by people would go across the U.S. border, which was basically unprotected and unregulated. So you had this huge influx of cheap labor, which kept the price of chicken production and so forth down, but at great human misery. just like in Mexico, in the maquiladora industries along the U.S.-Mexican border, you had the creation of 1,000 factories, but they were paying poorly, more so than other Mexican companies, but certainly not at adequate living standards. And the health and environmental conditions were abysmal to the extent that there was a turnover of 50% a year of those jobs, even though jobs were scarce in Mexico because of the repellent conditions there. Well, of course, it's now become a moot issue because those jobs are, as we mentioned, are migrating to China. And so not at the same time, you have Mexico, a country that basically discovered corn and which was and has been the very basis of the country's society, that U.S. subsidized corn is going to Mexico, underselling Mexican corn, and hundreds of thousands of Mexican farmers have had to sell their land and basically migrate, become migrants, illegal migrants to the United States because they no longer had a source of livelihood in Mexico.
What kind of fate do you think this agreement is going to face in Congress?
I think it's going to have a very rough fate, and I think the administration has no longer has the automatic state-of-the-art argument that only a fool would argue against free trade because free trade is good for everybody. We at last have the reaction now occurring of a skeptical U.S. community who no longer automatically buy the administration's free trade arguments, although this administration, you can be sure, is going to pump up the claims for free trade and is going to wage an all-out offensive to support free trade, even though free trade could have a negative impact on Bush's reelection plans.
This agreement comes against a backdrop of what looks like a rejection of neoliberalism in parts of Latin America, thinking Argentina, which is in some kind of debt moratorium. The president of Bolivia was driven out of office a couple of months ago. So it looks like the so-called Washington consensus that dominated the 80s and 90s is fraying at the edges at the very least. So what do you say of that general picture?
Well, the Washington consensus, which arose in the 1990s, early 1990s, basically said that there were kind of iron laws that were determined by the World Bank and the IMF, which involved such things as structural reforms, opening up markets, getting rid of public subventions, subsidies, and with a less of an interest in social desiderata, particularly if it drove up budgetary costs. So you wanted to get rid of public sectors, you wanted to privatize public companies, and what was private was good, and what was public is bad. Well, in an era of Enron and WorldCom and the mutual funds and the assumption that if the United States or if the average state had a sufficient number of assistant attorney generals to prosecute these U.S. companies, you would find very few U.S. companies that have not engaged in all sorts of illicit practices to prevent having to pay taxes and to maximize payments to their CEOs and their business partners. The Washington Consensus, which adamantly maintained and utilized its granting of credit accreditation and making standby loans and approving development plans, that they had a vice hold on Latin American developing institutions and governments and so forth. Well, there's been an extremely profound reaction to this. First of all, at the Cancun conference, where the World Trade Organization held its meeting, you had that meeting breaking up in disarray because a Brazil-led group, the group of 22, protested over what was taking place and argued that poverty could not be addressed as an issue by the strategy being used by the rich nations. That was followed up by the meeting that took place in Miami, negotiating the free trade area of the Americas, where Brazil and Argentina and a number of other Latin American countries stated that they're not going to sign an FTAA unless the United States eliminates its own subsidies, its $175 billion 10-year subsidy on U.S. agricultural products, which enabled, as I mentioned before, U.S. corn to undersell Mexican corn within Mexico. And so the United States agreed to a face-saving gesture that that each member of FTAA or each signatory could choose what it would agree to grant and what it would withhold in terms of its economic segments of its economy. And that represented a real defeat for the Bush administration. As I mentioned before, the unpopularity of Latin American presidents who were elected on populist tickets, but once they took office, immediately moved to the right. People like Lucio Gutierrez, who no longer has a majority of Ecuadorians backing him, but he, like Sanchez Lozada, the man who was ousted in Bolivia, he's running at a kind of 10 or 15% popularity rate, and what we have throughout the region are presidents that are loved in Washington because they are doing Washington's work in their own country, are despised in their own countries, and could very well have a very short tenure in their countries. I mean, right now, we are witnessing the rhetoric of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and the strong position that Brazil and Argentina has taken in challenging the verities of the World Bank and the other agencies, saying that we can no longer turn our backs on our own people, and development of our own countries comes first.
All right, well, thanks for your we'll conclude on that note. So thanks for joining us, Larry Burns.
Thank you.
That was Larry Burns, who is the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington, D.C. And it's interesting that Larry Burns said that the corporate scandals, the Enrons and WorldComs and such, have had an effect in Latin America in discrediting neoliberalism and the American economic model. I was constantly surprised how little in the way of political repercussions these scandals have had here, but it's at least somewhat comforting to know that they've had positive repercussions abroad. Also, a footnote, Larry Burns was the station manager of WBAI for one day in the early 1960s, a 10-year short even by the turbulent history of WBAI. And we'll be back in just a moment to hear from Simon Head after this word from the New Pornographers.
My service bent. Salvation, Hope at Central. Salvation, Hope at Central.
Pardon my hipster cliche, but those were the New Pornographers in a seasonally appropriate song. This is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And please do check out that website. Really good stuff on there, frequently updated. An excellent opportunity not only to catch up on the news and of the world and the news of WBAI, but also to make a pledge for this radio station, which is very much in need of your help, financial help. We need your support. Times are very, very tight around here, and the wolf is definitely scratching at the door. So please visit the web, the website, WBAI.org, and also consider, if you haven't done so already, making a pledge. You can do so with a credit card in a secure transaction on that website. And now, let's turn to an interview recorded earlier this week with Simon Head, who is the author of a book called The New Ruthless Economy, published by Oxford University Press for the Century Fund. And back in the 90s, we heard a lot about a wondrous new economy. I've written a book about it myself. Simon Head here takes a very close-up look at what it meant for workers, what this new magical world of work really, really means on the office floor or the factory floor or even the hospital floor. And it's a very important up-close look at what a lot of highfalutin management theory actually looks like on the ground. So let's listen to Simon Head. The new economy moment, at least in the late 90s, was frequently sold as a story of a wonderful new workplace, flat hierarchies, spontaneity, self-management, fun even. The recession has stripped away some of that, but it's also a time when we were told that Ford and Taylor were figures of the past as well. So what do you think of that initial sales pitch?
Well, obviously, I've written this book in order to refute that sales pitch. And my starting point really was the fact that although I'm prepared to acknowledge that productivity began to increase at a faster rate in the late 90s and to some extent in the new century, there was this emerging gap between the rate of increase of productivity and the rate of increase of compensation for most workers, which is wages plus benefits. There's a gap, and that has to be explained.
And, of course, the official story that productivity is important is because that is the ultimate determinant of living standards. So if we're having this situation of at least rising reported productivity and wages that are rising more slowly, where did the productivity revolution go?
Well, exactly. And that's why I thought one had to look at the ways in which technology is actually being used in the workplace. And with the generous support of the Century Foundation, I was able to devote a lot of time to doing that, to going around the country looking at workplaces and see how these new systems are actually used.
And let's start with a summary. What did you find in these workplaces? Was it the miracle of spontaneity and liberation and skill that the publicist said it was?
Well, I want to make two points there. I'm certainly not a Luddite. I think that technology can always be used in this way to enhance the experience and creativeness of individuals. But there are always choices about how it can be used. And it can also be used in the tradition of mass production and scientific management, that's to say, in the tradition of Ford and Taylor. And what I found looking at the workplace, and also looking at the trade literature, which is extremely important, is that there is an enormous degree of continuity between the present in the use of technology and actually a rather remote past.
Let's look at talk about a couple of these workplaces. In many ways, the prototype of the modern workplace is the call center. Tell us about what these things are and what they look like up close.
Well, this is an enormous industry. It employs up to 6 million people. There are 60,000 call centers, and our dealings with all kinds of business organizations, retail, wholesale, medical, products is through 1-800 numbers. And I found that this is an industry where really a very draconian form of scientific management has been introduced, which involves micromanaging the work of employees through things like the digital script, which we can talk about, and also introducing an extremely intrusive system of timing everything the employee does, and monitoring, surveillance of every movement to the toilet, to the lunchroom that the employee does.
We often call those 800 numbers and hear that the transaction may be recorded to aid in quality control. Yeah. What's really going on? Tell us about, first of all, the digital script.
Well, the digital script really is an extraordinary phenomenon, and it really does bring one back to the age of Ford and Taylor, because, you know, as we know, what Ford did on the assembly line was to determine in excruciating detail exactly what the worker had to do from second to second. And that's what the digital script really does. The employee is not allowed to carry on the conversation with us, the customer, in the way he thinks best. He's got to follow the script. And not only that, there are these things called branching scripts. In other words, when you have an interaction with the call center agent, you, the customer, may take the conversation in different ways. You can't anticipate exactly which direction the conversation is going to go, but the scientific managers have thought about that because they have what's called branching scripts. So you have icons at various stages on the script which the employee has to press when he thinks that the conversation is going in a particular way, and then the appropriate branching script comes up. I mean, it's really something out of George Orwell, I think.
Well, I believe you quote a consultant or a designer of one of these things who makes it sound as if the employee's script or the employee's behavior is like a computer program in which there's no room for spontaneity. Every eventuality has to be covered, and it's all a very closed system.
Well, that's the essence of what scientific management is, going way back to Taylor. The essence of it is that the expert, the managerial expert, has the superior knowledge, and what he's trying to do is to anticipate every contingency in work so he can cover it with the script, in this case, which he thinks is best. So he's superimposing his expertise on the expertise of the employee. So it really does reduce the employee to the level of a kind of human machine.
I'm speaking with Simon Head, author of The New Ruthless Economy, published by Oxford University Press for the Century Fund. Well, give us a sense of what it's like to work in one of these places. We have this worker who's got a script and also is timed. So what's it like to sit in that chair with the headphone on?
I think it's very oppressive. What I used to do, the heartland of the call center world is the Midwest, the sort of prairies. It's Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, also the mountain states, Arizona and New Mexico. I would go and I would talk to call center workers either when they had a meeting with union organizers, when all the grievances come flowing out, or I would go and talk to them during their break when they hang out in the parking lot, as it were. And it's very clear that it's an extremely oppressive work regime. You have no privacy. You're under surveillance all the time, and you're being judged all the time because the software is analyzing your performance in great detail in real time, and it's showing up in the console, in the control panels, which the supervisor is gazing at. So if you're falling behind, he's on to you at the next break. I think it's a very oppressive workplace.
And, of course, there's standards for the time in which a call center worker is supposed to dispose of a caller. What's that like?
Well, I mean, the essence of scientific management, going all the way back to Ford and Taylor, is the phenomenon of speed up, because you establish target times for everything, whether it's the motion on the assembly line or the time you take to dispose of a call in this case. But once you've established the time, you then start thinking of ways of speeding it up, and that's been true since 1913. And in scientific managers very much think in terms of tiny incremental elements of speed up. A second or 2 seconds is very significant, because if you multiply these seconds by hundreds of thousands of man hours, you begin to achieve serious savings. So speed up, trying to figure out ways in which the script and the performance can be made faster, is central to what's going on in these places.
One of the focal points of your book also is what's happened in the realm of managed care, HMOs, and all the other charming features of the new healthcare system. So, how has that been re-engineered according to the lines of ruthlessness you're analyzing?
Well, I mean, one of the things I did, and I think this is a way of trying to understand what I call the anthropology of these particular industries, is to read their trade literature, because this shows them facing inwards and talking to one another, not talking to the outside world in a kind of public relations sense. And, you know, I began to get these textbooks of re-engineering put out by what used to be called Anderson Consulting and Ernst & Young and the rest of them. And they're really talking about the industrialization of all kinds of procedures in services, like call centers, which we've just been talking about. But I then began to notice that healthcare and medicine began to show up in these manuals as just another industry to which these principles of industrialization could be applied. And that really astonished me, because I've always thought of medicine as something apart, which has to do with the nature of our humanity. But not so in the textbooks of re-engineering. The human being is an engineered product, just like a car, and once you make that assumption, you can then start applying all kinds of industrial principles to our treatment, and that essentially is what managed care tries to do.
Oh, in some sense, the essence of Taylorism is about de-skilling, or breaking down complicated processes into components which lower-skilled people can then perform.
That's
so
right.
if we're talking about medicine, though, we're talking about some of the most highly skilled workers in the labor force, doctors and other healthcare professionals.
That's right.
How much can that be broken down in Taylorized lines? Can they do it? Are doctors now, in a lot of ways, in some ways, like the expert mechanics of the 19th century?
I don't think you can do it, ultimately, because we are what we are, and we get ill in extremely idiosyncratic ways. But if we're talking at the level of ambition, what they're trying to do, they certainly are trying to de-skill the physician in a very significant way, because what they do is to, first of all, build up an enormous database concerning the patients who've got ill in certain ways, and the treatment and the result of the treatment. They then define certain patient categories. Then what they do is to get the physician to give the sort of broad diagnosis of what's wrong with the patient. So the patient can then be fitted in to a particular patient group, and then it's fed into the automated system, and out comes the appropriate treatment. And now that's why, in the heyday of managed care, 10, 15 years ago, you had this phenomenon called utilization review, which was medically untrained case managers employed by managed care companies presiding over rule books and databases and expert systems, ruling, judging, you know, what physicians could and could not do. Now, there's been a huge backlash against this, both by physicians and the patient population. And in most states, there is this automatic review of denials of treatment by managed care companies. But if you go back to their heyday, when they were much more powerful than they are now, this is what they did. And this is what they thought they could do, because they really did make this judgment that we are engineered products and we go wrong in standard ways, and we can be repaired in standard ways, like a washing machine.
I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that the heyday was 10, 15 years ago, because it seems like managed care increasingly pervades medicine. So what's the model now?
Well, because I think that very clearly has been a backlash against this. There has been a whole series of regulation growing up at the states, putting checks on these practices. So that's why I see healthcare as a mess, frankly, where you have the managed care industry, but you have all kinds of hedges against its most egregious practices. So you've got a sort of hybrid, neither one thing nor the other. And that's why I think, you know, you need to think in terms of a new healthcare system.
And we've been talking mostly about white-collar work of some sort or other, but the ruthlessness has also pervaded the factory itself, which was its birthplace in a lot of ways.
Yes.
What's happening in classic industry now? What advances in ruthlessness do we see on factory floors?
Well, I think the crucial event here, and the crucial event in what you might call the intellectual history of thinking about the workplace, was what happened when the Japanese came in to Western Europe and the United States with their new production methods. Because I think there's a high degree of consensus among economists and economic historians that Fordism and Taylorism were extremely influential in this country, certainly up to and after the Second World War. But the parting of the ways, as far as the interpretation of what's going on, really comes with the Japanese, because a lot of the rhetoric you led in with about the new emancipating workplace started coming up when the Japanese came in here, the Toyota system and the autonomous work teams on the assembly line and that sort of stuff. And I think that if there's a intellectual scoop in this book, it is that I actually went to the Japanese sources, the people who created the Toyota system. And one of them, the key architect, a man called Shingo, says in his own CV, which he includes at the end of the book, that one of the crucial events of his life was in 1931, when he read the Principles of Scientific Management, and he made a study and implementation of scientific management his life's work. And once you start looking at the Japanese system from that perspective, it's perfectly clear that that's exactly what it is. It tightens up the disciplines of scientific management, and it adapts them to some extent with routines in the factory which are more varied than they were in Ford's time. But that actually is something that Taylor himself anticipated. So that's the parting of the ways as far as the intellectual history of this is concerned.
I'm speaking with Simon Head, author of The New Ruthless Economy, just published by Oxford University Press. The people at Labor Notes like to use the phrase management by stress to describe what happened in factories, auto, particularly auto. But is this really the fundamental way that the American workplace is now being managed?
Well, I think it is. It certainly is in the call center world, because what you're doing is to go back to the concept of speed up. Counterintuitively, it's not a good thing if everybody is performing their routines comfortably and with time to spare, because it suggests that you can tighten up the routines and make them faster. And this is something that's very explicitly done in Japanese car plants, and it's what Labor Notes, Mike Parker and Jane Slaughter are referring to. They have a system of green lights and red lights, and the green light means that everybody is doing the routine comfortably, and that isn't necessarily a good thing. What you want is a significant minority of the red lights to be on, which means that people are having trouble. So you then bear down on those particular workers, and you see what they're doing wrong, so you can speed them up. So that's how the management by stress works in practice.
We've had enough of this now that we can maybe begin to draw some conclusions. Is this successful on its own terms? Is it good for managers? Is it good for companies? Is it produce higher productivity, higher profits? Or would a more humane system actually do those things better in the longer term?
Well, I draw a distinction here between, I actually draw a three-way distinction between manufacturing, areas of the service industry which are very light manufacturing, such as wholesale and retail distribution, and what I call core services, which are to do with you and I, the customer and the agent, having interactions. I'm prepared to concede that in the case of manufacturing and in the case of the service industries which are very like manufacturing, like wholesale and distribution, there is probably higher productivity by using these methods of speed up. But the point I would make there is that this is enormously open to abuse for the reasons we've discussed. The idea of management by stress, of pushing workers really harder than they should be pushed, underlines, in my view, the case for unions. And this has always been one of the great reasons for unions. They put a check on this, quite apart from negotiating decent wages and benefits. They put a check on scientific management, and that's still a very crucial role in manufacturing and in these areas of services which are very light manufacturing. But as far as the core services are concerned, in other words, where there's real human interaction, whether it's physicians or customer service, I think these methods don't work. I think that they provide inferior medicine and they provide inferior customer service. Now, if the statistics show otherwise, I want to look very closely at those statistics. And in those areas, I think there has to be a real change.
What might that change look like?
Well, I think that in medicine, you've got to restore the primacy of the physician. I realize that there were problems in the past, that the physicians, to some extent, abused their role as well. But I think you have to do that. I think you have to acknowledge that treating human beings is very complicated. It can't be standardized, and you've got to allow for the uniqueness of patients when they're seriously ill, and you've got to mold the way you treat them to that. And just as in customer service, you've got to acknowledge that these interactions actually are really quite complicated between individuals. There are all kinds of nuances, and they've been analysed brilliantly by the people out at Xerox PARC, and I must mention them as one of the great sources of creative writing in this whole area. And you've got to allow that to happen. That is the nature of good service, that you have people who are skilled and knowledgeable interacting with their customers and really ascertaining what they want.
But employers are not likely to do this on their own, so how's this going to happen?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. But there are encouraging things that are happening. I think there are signs that this whole revival of scientific management is to some extent imploding. There are various facets to that. There is the backlash against this kind of managerial automated medicine. There's the backlash against telemarketing and the law, which allows people to be free of it. And I think that's partly because it is such a strange automated interaction that people find extremely troublesome. There's another whole area which we haven't talked about, which is this extremely obscure but pervasive phenomenon of ERP, Enterprise Resource Planning, which applies re-engineering to practically everything a corporation does. It really tries to change corporations into enormous machines, led by this German software maker called SAP. There are signs that simply isn't working. And that one of the reasons why you have a problem with the levels of enterprise spending on information technology is because corporations are becoming very skeptical about these extremely elaborate, cumbersome business systems, which ERP is. So they may be slowly edging back to a more human-centered vision of how the corporation should work, I hope.
All right, let's conclude that optimistic note. Thanks for joining us, Simon Head. And that was Simon Head, author of a very fine new book called The New Ruthless Economy, just published by Oxford University Press. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And I'll be back next week with something on recording. Not sure where, but I'll be off celebrating the pagan holiday of Christmas. And let's go out with this bit, also for the New Pornographers, with Nico Case doing the lead singing.